You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko jo toku ingoa, nō mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rahina Monday. I'm your host Joel and I'll be with you for the next hour. Coming up on the show, for our weekly catch-up with the Axe Party, I spoke to MP Simon Court about the re-establishment of 10 polytechnics that were under Te Pukenga and Labour's Employment Relations Employee Remuneration Disclosure Amendment Bill. I spoke to the Equal Employment Opportunities Commissioner for the Human Rights Commission, Professor Gail Pacheco, about the Commission's calls for cross-party support for effective legislation to tackle modern slavery. I spoke to the Communications and Campaign Manager for Child Poverty Action Group, Isaac Gunson, about recently released research from the organisation that shows families below the income floor are struggling to cover basic necessities. I spoke to Carrie Leonetti, an Associate Professor in the Faculty of Law at the University of Auckland, about her research showing the family court is using, quote, junk evidence. Finally, I spoke to Jessica Ho from the University of Auckland about her master's thesis into sexual harm prevention in Aotearoa's music industry. He aho whakaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wai mai rānei, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Kaua e ware ware e ahei ana koto, te whakarongo ki e nei kōrero anō, hei pakiheri roki roki maoronga i te pai, tuku tuku i Dunningi Pōhō, me Heidi Key, 95BFM, Irakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
The government has recently announced that Te Pukenga is set to return to regional governance, re-establishing 10 polytechnics that were merged under the previous Labour-led government. For our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, I spoke to MP Simon Court about these developments with Te Pukenga. We also discussed Labour MP Kamala Belek's Members' Bill, the Employment Relations Employee Remuneration Disclosure Amendment Bill, passing its second reading. In the government, National are in support of the bill. However, New Zealand First and ACT are not. We discussed why ACT are not supportive of the bill, despite their coalition partner National being in support. But first, we discussed the re-establishment of the 10 polytechnics that were previously merged under Te Pukenga. Are ACT supportive of these developments?
Yeah, we certainly are. We campaigned against Labor's Te Pukenga reforms, which saw all the polytechnics which merged into one uneconomic and centralised institution. What we prefer is that each region has the ability to respond to local training and employment needs, and that's what the reforms that Minister Penny Simmons is delivering will do.
And you briefly touched on that, but what is the aim of re-establishing these polytechnics?
Well, the intention is that we're going to have polytechnics return to regional governance, which will include one that I attended, Unitech Institute of Technology, where I studied NZCE in civil engineering. That'll be merged with MIT to create one polytechnic for Auckland. And the intention is that for a quarter of a million, 250,000 students in the vocational education system each year, it means that their local institutions will be able to better tailor courses for their needs and for the employers in each region's needs. That's the purpose of restoring regional governance to the tertiary vocational education sector.
The Tertiary Education Union's National Secretary, Sandra Gray, told The Spin-off that 10% of the vocational education workforce was gone and had expected that 400 roles were likely to change. She also said staff were feeling major burnout and were covering for staff who had decided to leave. How will this move impact staff, and does the government have any plans to support staff who are currently burnt out due to the drastic changes we've seen Te Pukenga face?
That is really concerning to hear that. And I am aware that during the initial merger of all the institutions to Te Pūkenga, similar concerns were expressed, and particularly by staff who said, look, we don't know what our role will be in this Te Pūkenga beast, and we have no idea how we're going to explain to students that actually what we'll be delivering for them meets their needs. So understand that there's going to be some disruption as this is resolved, but what it will do is essentially restore to the status quo regional governance of polytechnics that we had before Te Pūkenga, and that should give those staff who wish to remain some confidence what the new structure will look like and what the type of roles will that they can expect to have in the new system.
And Te Pūkenga staff who are currently burnt out, does the government have any plans on helping them at the moment through this process?
Look, I'm not aware of specific support for individual staff members who need it, but of course that is an obligation on employers. What I'm really interested in is how these vocational institutions can support this next wave of economic development that New Zealand's about to embark on, in particular support the $6 billion in infrastructure projects that was confirmed over the weekend by Minister Chris Bishop. Because if you think about where I studied, Unitech Institute of Technology, back in the 1990s, was producing over 200 engineering graduates a year who were working and studying and who were able to immediately contribute to construction, design, supervision, actually delivering infrastructure the day that they graduated, in fact before, because they were working and studying. Same with surveyors, drafts people. Look, it's really important that we re-establish and reinvigorate the sector. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to deliver on the infrastructure outcomes that this government's planning to invest in.
Moving on to our next topic. Last week, Labor MP Kamala Bellick's Members Bill, the Employment Relations Employee Remuneration Disclosure Amendment Bill, passed its second reading. The bill would allow workers to discuss their salaries without being gagged by their employer through their contracts. All opposition parties and National support the bill. Why has ACT not joined their coalition partner National in supporting this bill?
Well, ACT opposes the bill because it represents a one-size-fits-all mandate from Wellington that overrides freedom of contract and ignores how real workplaces function. And I think it's telling that you have chosen to describe a willing employee contracting arrangement as applying some kind of gag. An employee has the choice not to contract with an employer who imposes terms and conditions they disagree with. All ACT is saying is that we must maintain the integrity of individual employment contracts where individuals, whether it's employer, employee, agree that, you know what, it's not appropriate in our workplace to discuss salary and those type of terms and conditions. It introduces a risk of resentment. Frankly, it's unhelpful for morale and productivity. And there's just no way that central government in Wellington can impose a blanket rule that is best for everyone in every cafe, every clinic or every construction site. It's not feasible.
In the second reading of the bill, ACT's Parmjeet Palmer says the bill will not fix pay parity, pay discrimination and the gender pay gap. However, Bellick, in the same reading, she said the bill itself will not solve all issues of inequality and fairness in the country, but is in a small part a path New Zealand needs to go down to fix these inequalities. Does the ACT party acknowledge that this bill could address and work towards bettering these inequalities?
We don't make legislation in New Zealand because something could work. Making regulations, making laws is serious business. You have to have a pretty good evidence base that the changes you're proposing to make in legislation are going to work. Camilla Belich's reckons, unfortunately, do not reach a sufficient bar. And you just need to think about the practicality of it. I mean, imagine you're in a startup business and employees joining a business that's just getting off the ground might choose to make a trade-off between, you know, their weekly take-home pay, shares in a business, or maybe the flexibility to work in a business that's just getting going that they can transition into a more comprehensive full-time role in future. But if we're going to ask all these employees, we're going to give them the ability to disclose all of their terms and conditions that they've agreed with the business owner, then you lose the ability to actually innovate, to be agile and tailor packages to individuals' needs, and you just risk flattening and standardising contracts, which makes no one better off in the long run.
In her speech, Bellick acknowledged ACT's differing view, especially around that pay is private information. However, she says there is nothing in the bill requiring an individual to do anything other than keep that information private. She adds that she hopes the party receives assurance in the way the bill has been drafted. Will the ACT party support the bill in its third reading?
Well, we haven't supported the bill because we don't agree with its intention. We oppose it on principle. It's a one-size-fits-all mandate from Wellington that overrides freedom of contract, and ACT cannot support that.
That was the ACT Party's Simon Court on the re-establishment of polytechnics previously merged under Te Pukenga, and Labor's Members' Bill, the Employment Relations Employee Remuneration Disclosure Amendment Bill.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
That's probably slightly off topic. What was the question again?
The Wire.
Te Kahui Tika Tanaka, the Human Rights Commission, are calling for cross-party support for slavery laws. This follows members' bills from both sides of the House to tackle modern slavery. I spoke to the Equal Employment Opportunities Commissioner for the Commission, Professor Gail Pashinko, about these calls. What are Aotearoa's current slavery laws looking like?
Well, what the Human Rights Commission have asked for is a cross-party consensus on having a modern slavery legislation, because we believe we need specific legislation. If we have strong modern slavery legislation in New Zealand, that will protect people working in our country, and it'll ensure we're not buying goods made with modern slavery as well.
And what does modern slavery look like in the country?
Well, modern slavery exists in New Zealand, but it also exists throughout the world. So this is where people are made to work against their will. They might be bonded to a job through debt traps, or are forced or tricked away from their home to work under exploitative conditions.
Have we seen a rise in modern slavery in recent years in the country?
Well, we've certainly seen a number of cases of modern slavery. There's clear evidence that it exists both in New Zealand and elsewhere. You know, it could look like a migrant worker. There's many reports of migrant workers who are forced to pay for jobs and end up in debt to the employer, so they can't leave or don't receive promised jobs at all and end up destitute in New Zealand. And there's also been cases of individuals charged with slavery in New Zealand. And what I also wanted to point out is there's modern slavery happening overseas, which is used to produce the products we use, such as our clothing, our shoes, coffee, etc. And this legislation is about companies reporting back on their anti-slavery efforts so that we're not buying products that is made with modern slavery.
Despite private members' bills from MPs across the political aisle, is the Commission concerned with the feasibility of cross-party support for this legislation, especially with the different views of each party represented in Parliament?
So I think it's heartening that there's bills introduced from both sides of the political spectrum, because that shows that there is some consensus in terms of knowing this is an issue that we need to address in New Zealand. So there's clearly some consensus that modern slavery exists and this is something we need to tackle. And so I would encourage our politicians to do what's right and work together to ensure that this occurs.
How urgent is cross-party support needed?
I think it's an important matter to ensure that we give modern slavery legislation a go, because we pride ourselves on giving everyone a fair go. So we need this kind of legislation to protect people working in our country and to ensure we're not buying goods made with modern slavery.
Would the Commission want these calls to be extended to local governments and how they can contribute?
Well, at the core of this proposal, it's about large companies. So they're the companies that have the resources that can report back on their anti-slavery efforts. And these are companies that have over $50 million in turnover.
Do you think people are sort of aware of the modern slavery element of these companies and that they're using modern slavery?
No, I think most Kiwis will not realise that they're buying products that may be relying on supply chains that are impacted by exploitation and modern slavery. I've seen some reports that say, I think there was one by World Vision that estimated that New Zealanders spend $77 a week on such supply chain products.
And what would the Commission's ideal legislation and cross-party support look like regarding tackling modern slavery?
Well, I agree with the core of the proposal in that large companies become mandatory for them to report back on their anti-slavery efforts, and this increases transparency, and this should help reduce modern slavery and ensure we're not buying goods made with it, as well as ensure we have strict enforcement and penalties so that we limit the cases where there may be modern slavery existing in New Zealand as well.
How important is it for Te Tiriti o Waitangi to be engaged in this process?
As a Human Rights Commission, we believe that's important in all processes we're tackling, whether it be modern slavery or even talking about the wider issues around migrant exploitation or any other labour market aspect as well. My ending message is that I think it's important that no matter where we're born or what job we have, everyone has the right to live in working conditions that uphold our human dignity, and hence the importance of strong modern slavery legislation in New Zealand.
That was the Human Rights Commission's Gail Pacheco on the Commission's calls for bipartisan support for legislation to tackle modern slavery.
So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire.
We'll be right back. Text in on 5395 on any of your thoughts on these pieces.
Forget about ganja grapefruit. Who even cares about marijuana mango? We're all about Dope Lemon, making his way back to our shores on the back of his stonking new record, Golden Wolf, playing August 8 at the Auckland Town Hall. Love yourself some dreamy, laid-back grooves with deeply introspective lyricism? Sounds like you need to go see Dope Lemon, August 8th at the Auckland Town Hall. Tickets from livenation.co.nz.
It's music.
95 BFM.
Broadcast to the world and podcast to your device. Go to 95BFM.com for show podcasts.
Arcade Radio, Thursday nights, 7 to 9 p.m. Classic bands, scalding hot takes, and advice on how to cuff your pants. It could only be Auckland's leading skate brand affiliated radio show.
Arcade Radio, for all that and music from all corners of the globe, tune in to Arcade Radio Thursday nights from 7 to 9 p.m. with Dylan Biscuit and Leon Aoki.
Yeah, yeah. Arcade Radio, only on 95 BFM.
You gotta see reason. He's been applying to children. We were huddled around a cartridge, chilled by such a talent. Price, I need some explaining, and not the kind I received in Albert Park. I don't need condescending. Your eyes tell me wrong. I'm on the broadest mission. Mission. She talks like the others. Midway through my words, they just cut out in the hallway being governed. Her eyes are craters as she watches. watches. Now I'm in the order that I should be, in the order that I should be. I can't help it if I make you frown. Forward we go, let down. Tells me to be patient, to listen in the dark spaces, waiting for my time to come, but it hasn't. She sounded so sure of herself, herself. Now I'm in the order that I should be, in the order that can't help it if I make you fall. Forward we go, let down. Ah, forward we go, let down.
That was Let Down by Ben Chavasse. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
In recently released research from the Child Poverty Action Group, the research shows low-income families below the income floor are struggling to pay for bare essentials. Below the income floor refers to the minimum income needed to live and belong. I spoke to Isaac Gunson, a spokesperson from the organization, about these findings. What does this research show that previous research is not showing?
What this research shows is that more and more the incomes for low-income households are simply not keeping up. We've managed to model 39 different kinds of households with varying levels of income. It's very thorough, and the next steps that we're going to take is using integrated data infrastructure, IDI data from the government, which it plans to use to replace things like the census, to really get a sense of, now that we've modelled the households, how many households across Aotearoa fit into each of the categories and models that we've done.
Have benefits and wage increases made much of an impact to low-income households, especially amidst the cost of living crisis?
We saw a real big impact with the 2022 wellbeing budget, but unfortunately what we've seen in the years since is a lot of those gains have been lost in terms of the purchasing power of low-income households' income. And what our projections are is that that's simply going to get worse and leave families and low-income households worse off.
The research fleshes out the modelling of the Welfare Expert Advisory Group, or WEAG, looking at 39 different low-income households across the past 8 years. In 2018, we saw the Child Poverty Reduction Act come into play. How much of an impact has this framework had on the 39 households in this research?
Look, you can almost sort of, it's almost a mirror, right? So, you know, in the same period of time that we were watching child poverty rates decrease, we were watching income adequacy for those low-income households increase. Now, child poverty rates are back, you know, on the rise, and income adequacy is declining once again. So there's a very clear mirror when it comes to how this income inadequacy is affecting the number of children who are experiencing material hardship.
And what outcomes are we seeing for children in this research?
The models show that more and more children are going to have to go without. Now, whether that's without maybe a school trip a year, or maybe that's without internet access at their homes, because the deficits that these households are in when it comes to, you know, income versus expenses is, you know, in some cases it's a hundred or more dollars a week. And so what that's leaving parents with is the really tough decisions. You know, do we run the heaters this month? Can we afford to run the heaters? Do we need to cancel our internet plan so that we can afford the power? And all of that is going to have an impact not just on the well-being and the upbringing of children, but also their ability to participate in society meaningfully as a child. You know, you think about a lot of the things that a lot of us take for granted, having access to things like the internet, really important for homework, research, but also like just staying in contact with friends and family that you don't live with. Having to make a choice that could mean not having internet access at home so that you can, you know, start to make ends meet a little bit closer, that's going to have a long-lasting effect on tamariki as they grow up, because it essentially excludes them from a really important part of society, and that is the real shame of these tough decisions that families are having to make.
What would Child Poverty Action Group like to see in this space?
So this research is centred around the idea of the income floor. So any families who are below the income floor simply not making enough. And our research shows most of the modelled households are below that income floor. We're calling on the government to rebase incomes back up to the floor. You know, it's nothing super duper fancy. We're just saying the bare minimum to, you know, pay for core essentials, so housing, power, and basic food, and then participatory costs. So, you know, those school trips every now and then, being part of a sports team, any of those extracurricular activities that help children develop, and also, you know, their participation leads to prevention, really, of worsening statistics. Because the best way to help a child's outcomes is to increase their parents' incomes.
You have briefly touched on this, but what is next for this research project?
The models that we've done so far help us to standardise the picture. The next phase is going through the government's IDI data and taking those model households and mapping them onto the reality of Aotearoa so that we know exactly how many households are in this model deficit, or perhaps in another case, in this model surplus. But the core fact remains the majority of the different kinds of households on those low incomes that we've modelled trending down and pretty universally will be worse off next year than they are this year. Every child that we can lift above the income floor is a prevention success that we can measure. And, you know, at the end of the day, whatever it may cost now to lift those incomes to a livable level, there's nothing next to the cost that we will see borne out across our health system, our education system, and our justice system if we don't solve this problem now.
That was the spokesperson for the Child Poverty Action Group, Isaac Gunson, on the organisation's recently released research.
The Wire.
According to a new journal article by assistant professor in the Faculty of Law at the University of Auckland, Carrie Leonetti, the family court is using poor quality evidence in rulings. I spoke to Leonetti about her findings and what implications using faulty evidence has on the children involved in these cases. What are we seeing regarding how judges, lawyers, and psychologists provide evidence in Aotearoa's family court?
Bit of background before I directly answer your question, which is I've done research before into expert evidence in the family court. So when expert psychologists prepare reports for the court around the best interests of children in custody proceedings, or they offer testimony. And the research suggests that a lot of the expert witnesses in the family court are not qualified to perform those evaluations, give that opinion evidence, and that the courts are failing to kind of screen out evidence that isn't based on sort of scientific validity and reliable application. That's the background to all of this. But when I was doing that research into the sort of expert testimony that psychologists were giving in the court, I actually just noticed some things that jumped out at me, and in particular around discussions that either judges or lawyers or psychologists who work in the family court were having of what they claimed to be basically was psychological literature. And I just kind of, it was just really jarring to me that they would talk about, like a judge or a lawyer or a psychologist would say, the literature shows, the research shows, studies show. And what I noticed is, first of all, they wouldn't identify the research. So it was like the research shows, not Brown in 2005 in this journal article did this study and these were the results. I also noticed that a lot of what followed the sort of precursors of studies show or research shows were just quite frankly ridiculous, just absolutely preposterous propositions. So studies show that all children are better off in joint custody. Studies show that 90% of disclosures of child sexual abuse are false. No, they don't. I mean, that is absolutely ridiculous. There are no studies that show that, and I would love if they specified it to see which ones did. I noticed they used a lot of what I would consider to be very unscientific descriptions of the research. So they really like words like all, none, always, never. So all studies show that something never happened, which is never how science works. There is never 100% consensus in a field, and no individual study ever shows that something happens 100% of the time. I mean, just to give you an example, there's a very strong statistical link between smoking and lung cancer. People who smoke are four times as likely to get lung cancer as people who don't, which is a really strong causal relationship. But not all people who smoke get lung cancer, and not all people with lung cancer smoke. There are no 100% always, never, all, none relationships in science. I also noticed that on the rare occasion when they actually did specify the literature that they were basing their, the judgment on in the case of the family court, or they were submitting to the court if it was a lawyer or a psychologist, it wasn't science research. It wasn't peer-reviewed health research, peer-reviewed psychology research. It was things like unpublished training materials or just pop psychology, like books you would buy at the airport bookstore in the self-help section. The other huge thing I noticed is, despite all of these constant references to studies and the literature and research, they actually are missing the single most important body of research in the entire field of psychology that bears on the question the family court has to answer. I should probably back up and say 80% of custody cases in the family court are between a domestic violence perpetrator and a domestic violence victim. The perpetrator is seeking care of the children that the victim thinks is unsafe, which is why it's fascinating to me that you never in the family court cases see them cite literature relating to ACEs, which stands for adverse childhood experiences. The ACE literature is a body of thousands, probably tens and maybe even hundreds of thousands of studies that basically measure the relationship between exposure to trauma and in particular family and sexual violence in childhood and long-term devastating social, psychological, and even physical health consequences. So for instance, kids who are exposed to abuse as children are far more likely to develop diabetes or cancer in adulthood than people who don't have traumatic violence exposures in childhood, let alone the sort of psychiatric type issues you'd expect, like self-harm, low self-esteem, substance abuse issues. None of this is cited. It's always unspecified literature or pop psychology literature and never like real peer-reviewed science research, in particular into childhood trauma. So I decided to measure this. Just in a separate study, I thought, I have got to just mathematically measure what the hell they're talking about when they talk about literature, so-called literature in the family court. And these are some of the results of my study. So in 83% of the cases in which a judge claimed that they were basing a custody decision on so-called literature, research, or studies, they didn't indicate what it was. They didn't say who the author was, what the publication was, let alone describe what the study actually studied and the results of the study. 83% of the time, it was just the research shows or the studies show. In 77% of the cases in which they claimed to be basing their decision-making on the literature or the research, the so-called literature favored, like ideologically favored, perpetrators of family violence. It's ideological literature that kind of minimizes, sidelines, or distracts from the issue of violence. So they're not citing, they're not claiming like the literature shows exposure to child abuse does long-term damage to kids. It does. It's the literature shows that child abuse isn't that big of a deal. The literature shows that abuse perpetrators don't repeat their abuse. I mean, just crazy sort of Darvo-ish so-called literature. The one that really killed me is in 67% of the cases in which a family court custody decision is based on so-called research or literature, it is research or literature into the discredited theory of, quote, parental alienation. 67% of the so-called research they're basing their decisions on is parental alienation research. And I will tell you why that one really galled me. About 2 years ago, New Zealand was undergoing its ninth periodic review for its compliance with the World Gender Equality Treaty by the United Nations Committee on against Discrimination Against Women. And the government gets a list of questions they're asked to answer in their report to the United Nations. And one of the questions the UN asked is, what are you going to do about your family court's use of the discredited, dangerous theory of parental alienation? And when the Ministry of Justice responded to the UN's inquiry 2 years ago, they responded with, we don't use it. We know that parental alienation is dangerous. We know that it's discredited. We know that it's junk science, and our family court isn't using it. No, 67% of the time that the family court claims they are basing custody decisions on so-called scientific research is the theory of parental alienation. The theory of parental alienation has been disavowed by all of the world's psychology, psychiatry, and medical associations. Since 2019, the World Health Organization has had a page on their website explaining why they won't put parental alienation into the International Classification of Diseases. And it's because it lacks any evidence basis. And our government told the UN 2 years ago our family court wasn't using this theory. I looked at cases between 2014 and 2022, and 67% of the time they claim to be using psychology literature. It's this like ideological crap about the theory of parental alienation. I found that 17%, so that those are the cases where they basically don't specify the literature or it's parental alienation literature. In the cases where they specify the literature, 17% of the time they grossly misconstrued it. So just to give you one example, there's an article they love in the family court fight. It's called Fiddler and Bala, Barbara Jo Fiddler and Nicholas Bala from 2010. They cite it over and over again for the proposition that the overwhelming majority of children's disclosures of child abuse are false, sometimes specifically for the proposition that 90% of children's disclosures of child abuse are false. Fiddler and Bala, in a really methodologically unsound study, but Fiddler and Bala found that 11% of children's disclosures of child abuse are false. So they're citing it for the opposite of what the actual article says. I also found on the rare occasion when they tell you what they mean by literature, that they have four favorites, four authors that they cite over and over again. In literally a mathematical majority of the time they identify a study, it's one of four studies, from one of four people. In 50% of the cases in which they actually specify who the research is, it's one guy, Richard Warshak, who is a paid American expert witness. He's just a paid expert witness. He testifies on behalf of violent parents in custody proceedings in the U.S. He has no academic affiliation, no affiliation with any research laboratory. The Fiddler and Bala article is number two. That's a law review article. Barbara Jo Fiddler, again, is a paid family court consultant in, I think, the United States. Nick Bala is a law professor in Canada. It's in a law review. And then the third one is a woman named Emmy Baker. She is also a paid American expert witness. She's not even a clinical psychologist. She's an educational psychologist. She makes her money testifying in family courts. And the criminal division of the New York, appellate division of the New York Supreme Court has had some colorful things to say about Dr. Baker, and they're not flattering. That's who they're basing their decision making on. The incredible thing, though, was the lack of scientific literature. So what they're basically using as so-called literature in the family court is just people's random partisan opinions and advocacy. In fact, a lot of what they're using is glorified training materials and marketing materials. In the there were 31 sources. There were 31 times in that period of time where the family court said, we're basing this on the literature, the research study, where I could actually identify what it was. 21 times it was a law review article. That is two-thirds of the time. It was a little more than two-thirds of the time. It's a law review article. And I say this as a legal academic. I published in law review articles, but that is not scientific research. Four times it's a psychology theory journal. So it's not like quantified data, evidence-based stuff. It's more like the kind of journal Freud would publish in if he were still alive. Three of the times, it was just handouts from legal seminars or training. Two of the time, it was popular psychology books, so books published in the popular press, like Random House and Penguin. No offense to them, but not academic research. One time, it was a psychiatry textbook. Like if you took Psych 101, it was a textbook that would be assigned for the class. There was not a single reference to a peer-reviewed science journal or to any scientific research hall in all of the family court judgments I could find where they claim to be basing their decisions on research. Instead, it's just like psychobabble nonsense.
What are the repercussions with ruling based on evidence that has not been peer-reviewed, especially on children?
So this is one of the really horrifying things is it's not like they're just pulling at random a bunch of garbage. That would obviously just lead to unpredictable, unreliable, inaccurate decision-making. But it's actually putting a thumb on the scale, right? So they're not this sort of scientific research about ACEs, which would demonstrate that children being exposed to family violence is incredibly damaging to them. Instead, they're using this, like, you know, marketing materials for these expert witnesses in America, claiming that, like, parental alienation, that not having a relationship with a violent father does more harm to a child than being protected from ongoing violence. So it's not just that they're cherry-picking junk psychology over the actual scientific research coming out of, like, labs and academic institutions, but it's that it has an ideological tilt. I mean, the constant sort of criticism of our family court is that they lack a specialized evidence-based understanding of family violence or risk assessment with regarding to child safety. And instead, they sort of subscribe to these pervasive myths and misunderstandings. Like, they didn't know that partner violence is situational. So as long as the victim and the perpetrator separate, there won't be any more violence, which is the opposite of what studies show. Studies show that the risk both to the primary victim and to children increases, including the risk of lethality increases in about 2 years after separation, And, you know, these sort of pervasive myths that there's somehow no relationship between intimate partner violence and child abuse. Like somebody can be incredibly violent to a partner, but they can just still be a good enough father. So it's not just that they're ignoring the science that says otherwise. They're cherry picking the non-science that sort of feeds into this need to put children in the custody of violent, in particular, fathers. And I just want to give you an example out of a case. This is like an actual case that I found, just so people get a flavor of this. So this is a custody battle between a father with a history of family violence and a protective victim mother who was worried about the child in care of the father. So the lawyer for the father says this. This is in quotation marks. This is a quote. The literature on the impact of children being caught in parental conflict is never benign. Parental alienation is the most damaging experience that a child could have, and children who are exposed to parental alienation have a strong likelihood of developing a disturbance in their growing identity. Mom's lawyer responded with, basically, her exact words were overly simplistic. I think that's an overly simplistic understanding of the psychological literature. Yeah, you think? I'm pretty sure the literature doesn't show that parental alienation is more harmful to children than being exposed to violence. The judge sided with the father, and this is a direct quote from the judge. There is, quote, a consensus, and so just to be clear, no literature is specified. There is a consensus that it is central to every child's well-being and development that they have a positive paternal relationship. So the judge claims, without citing any studies, that 100% of children will be damaged if they're not in the shared care of their father, even in a case where the father is violent. That is the consequence of basing your decision-making on unspecified literature, on pseudoscientific parental alienation literature, on marketing materials from paid American expert witnesses who make their money testifying on behalf of violent fathers in American family courts, and just insisting that there's a global consensus that something is central to every child. I mean, you know you're not dealing with science when you see a word like every. You know you're not dealing with science when you say there's a universal consensus. Just to put this in perspective for you, in the context of the question of whether human activity affects climate change, has an impact on the climate, there's still about 6% of climatologists who don't think so, that don't think human behavior, like things like factories and pollution and carbon dioxide, you know, release, has any impact on climate change. There is never 100% consensus in the field. And I think the consensus on the relationship between human activity and climate change is one of the strongest I've ever seen in a scientific field. So of course, there is not a universal consensus that all children have to be in the custody of their father or they'll have damaged well-being and development. That's insane. There's no literature that shows that all children who live in the home of a single mother end up damaged in adulthood. There is literature that shows a strong statistical relationship between being exposed to a violent father's violence and long-term terrible psychosocial and physical health consequences. They're picking crappy literature that leads to a really unsafe outcome over the real scientific literature that would lead to much safer outcomes for children in the court.
With your findings, how would you like to see the space better regulated?
In the first instance, I would like to see family court judges be much more careful what they're basing their decision-making on. I mean, like I said, my earlier research indicates that they are allowing psychologists to give testimony in their court that is not sort of based on scientifically validated research and is not applied in a reliable way in a forensic context. And in fact, they're allowing psychologists to testify who don't have any forensic qualifications. They're also apparently allowing not just psychologists, but lawyers at this point in time, lawyers for the parents, lawyers for the child, to sort of give their imprimatur on this supposed social science literature. So they just need to stop. They need to acknowledge that if you're going to try to use science to enhance your decision making, it needs to be good science that's offered by qualified experts. They need to use validated science that's being explained to the court by an expert who's qualified to do so, and stop just letting, for example, a lawyer for the child or a lawyer for a violent father give them some assurance in a court submission that the research says something. Second, appeals courts have to do something about this. There's actually quite a lot of case law at the appellate level that says that lawyers and judges should not use social science evidence, even good social science evidence, in the absence of sort of scaffolding of expert evidence, right? So an expert can give an expert opinion and then explain to the court the literature on which they're basing the opinion. But the fact of the matter is lawyers and judges shouldn't be playing games with so-called social science literature at all. No judge should say, I'm familiar with the literature. This is a quote out of a different case from a judge. The judge said that he was basing his custody decision, this is giving custody to a violence perpetrator, and this is what he said, on my, quote, this is in quotes, general knowledge of the psychological and sociological literature in relation to child development. So no appellate court should let that stand. A judge cannot make a decision on what they claim to be their general psychological and sociological knowledge. If the judge needs psychology expertise to make a decision, they need to get a qualified psychologist to explain the literature to them. And there's actually, there are cases on this, on how lawyers shouldn't be making submissions about social science evidence. Judges shouldn't be sort of taking judicial notice of social science evidence. So appellate courts have to start stepping in and overturning these custody decisions and saying to family court judges, you can't call on qualified experts, you can't let experts testify to opinions that aren't based on reliable methodology, and you can't just make decisions on some, you know, unspecified literature, psychology literature, or worse yet, junk science literature that has an incredibly partisan and ideological tilt to it. I mean, this sort of has to be cleaned up.
That was the University of Auckland's Carrie Leonetti on using poor quality evidence in family court rulings. We'll be right back.
Block Party, performing Silent Alarm in full, live at Spark Arena, Tuesday, August 12th.
Optimistic as a team, now it's terror. Airplanes crash into town. The demo says the enemy's among us, taking our women and taking our jobs. A reasonable fool is being drenched by the non-stop bang, bang, bang the drum. So I go hunting for witches. I go hunting for witches. Heads up, going to roll. I got plenty of was an ordinary man with an ordinary desire. I watched TV and formed me. I was an ordinary man with an ordinary desire. There must be a kind of ability. This power time is informed. Fear will keep us all in place.
that song is Dead by Sudan Archives. And before that, you had Hunting for Witches by Block Party. Welcome back to The Wire.
When you see Paris Hilton carrying a chihuahua in a handbag, then suddenly there's going to be a certain segment of the New Zealand population that are suddenly going to want a chihuahua.
The Wire.
Jessica Ho, as a part of her master's thesis at the University of Auckland, looked into sexual harm prevention in Aotearoa's music industry. For her research, she spoke to men involved in the industry on their knowledge of sexual harm and sexual harm prevention. On Saturday, I spoke to her about her research. Could you explain how you went about this research and why you specifically chose to angle it by engaging with men in Aotearoa's music industry?
I am a musician myself, and there was a lot of conversations at the beginning of 2021 around the prevalence and impact of sexual harm in the Aotearoa music community, and it was seeming to be impacting women and gender diverse people at quite a much greater extent, and sort of with the implication that also men were probably doing more of the harm. And that's not to say that men, you know, everyone of any gender harms, and you know, men can be harmed, but on balance, men were doing more of the harm. So it's sort of thought it was quite important to get men focused on getting men engaged in this issue. And well, without their engagement, we can't kind of move forward enough. And so, yeah, so that's why I wanted to, and I also had an interest in engaging men in prevention in general with my postgraduate studies. And so I decided to do a master's research project talking to men about the issue of sexual harm and their role in prevention.
What is different, or are there any differences between the music industry here in the country as opposed to other industries if we're looking at sexual harm?
I think that's a question. I think because the music community is quite unique in terms of it's quite loose in the way it's structured. There's lots of, you know, people don't necessarily work at a workplace, and you know, an official workplace, you know you could call working doing a gig your workplace, but yeah, like it's not an official organization. You don't, so it's all very loose. Lots of people do it sort of part-time or just for fun, and so there's sort of no kind of formal way of that the protections and sort of set up policies or kind of modes to deal with it compared to other workplaces. And then the environment itself is quite challenging. You know, your late nights and your social blurs into your work, and there's all these sort of things that get quite messy.
Were the findings in your research what you expected?
Not exactly, but you never know what you're going to get when you talk to the men. Some of it was, some of it kind of aligned with quite a bit of the research, especially around how people understand the music community, things like how people understand it as, you know, access to powerful people is very critical still. It seems to that trope of who you know, not what you know, seems to hold strong, and that sort of still impacts people's ability to engage and intervene in prevention. But some really positive things that I wasn't necessarily expecting was how people talked about their relationship to, some of the men talked about their relationship to the music community as community, like they really saw it as this collaborative place where everyone was connected, and they were really pushing for the idea of that, you know, we all should be looking out for one another, and why wouldn't you want to make the music community good for everyone? So it's sort of that kind of social responsibility kind of idea that we're all responsible, even if we don't directly harm, to, you know, ensure no one gets harmed so everyone can, you know, flourish and enjoy being part of the music community, which I thought was really cool to hear. And one other thing was how some of the men had really thought quite deeply about the issue, actually, and had really started working on themselves in a way, and were like really thinking about their own behaviours and their own roles in it, and what they've done in the past, and how they can kind of work on them, what they do to make sure that, you know, they are keeping the environment around them safe.
How does the music industry correlate with understandings of sexual harm and consent?
Well, one of the things that came up in the group discussions, and especially it was about that kind of power aspect and how consent, you know, like saying it's not always, even if you sort of consent to doing something, you might not really be wanting to do it, but it's sort of, there's this coercive and sometimes not even spoken pressure to go along with something because you're worried that if you say no, that's going to harm your career, or I'll never get asked to do anything again. So it does problematize consent, because when you've got these power imbalances, then people, you know, don't have the power to consent in a sort of in a proper way. They're kind of being subtly coerced, even if it's not verbalized.
What does sexual harm prevention, especially if we are looking at the music industry, look like?
Well, there's been a few things that people have started, like the Soundcheck Aotearoa has been doing some great work, and they've got all these resources on their website, you know, to help people and things, you know, to create code of conduct and policies and things like that. And also they've been running workshops. And I suppose for me, one of the things that I really think is important from coming out of the research is that because these issues are quite complex, doesn't mean that they're too hard to talk about, but there's a lot of things to think about. We just really need to keep these conversations going and actually talking amongst ourselves and actually starting to sort of challenge some of the things that we think about, like how we think about the music community, and, you know, do we need to like sort of reflect on, is this the best way to make it function if it's creating an environment where it's sort of enabling sexual harm? So it's sort of just keeping these conversations, and I'm hoping to organise a webinar where we come together and I'll share some of my research, but also have some brainstorming about ideas to move forward, and just to get people to think about it in a deeper way, I think, and just to keep talking to your friends and your mates. And if you see someone doing something a bit weird, you know, just going up and, you know, questioning them in a non-confrontational way, you know, just kind of getting confident to start talking to people about the topic, because also I feel like it's still a little bit of a taboo topic, sexual harm.
What do you hope comes from this research?
So I suppose hopefully give some insights for the people that are doing some of this work, like the Soundcheck Aotearoa and other people and other community groups that are, you know, wanting to do this change. And yeah, just to kind of provoke people to think about it, even if they don't agree with everything I say, like, because, you know, it's all just my, you know, framing and how I've come to those conclusions, you know, from other research. But, you know, I've framed it, you know, it still gets people to think about it and to realise that this is a long term, you know, we have to keep going at it. You can't solve it in like just, you know, a few months. So we have to just keep going at it. And this is just, I thought, a good time, you know, thing to bring that back into the conversation.
That was the University of Auckland's Jessica Ho on her master's thesis, looking into sexual harm prevention in Aotearoa's music industry.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. Nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I korero mai ki maua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Monday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. The ACT Party Simon Court, the Human Rights Commission's Gail Pashiko, the Child Poverty Action Group's Isaac Gunson, and the University of Auckland's Carrie Leonetti and Jessica Ho. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakaronga ana. Thank you for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Florence.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.